Reborn every 600 years in man's reckoning of time, the gargoyles joined battle against man to gain dominion over the earth. In each coming, the gargoyles were nearly destroyed by men who flourished in greater numbers. Now it has been so many hundreds of years that it seems the ancient statues and paintings of gargoyles are just products of man's imagination. In this year, with man's thoughts turned toward the many ills he has brought upon himself, man has forgotten his most ancient adversary, the gargoyles.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
That opening was a tiny excerpt from the 1972 made-for-TV film Gargoyles. It's not a great movie, though lots of people have had fun watching it. I suppose it's mostly notable for its special effects work by a young artist named Stan Winston. At the time I'm recording this, you can check that film out on YouTube, and I put a link to it in our show notes at monstertalk.org. This week, we're taking a look at gargoyles. Now, this is tricky, since primarily gargoyles are, strictly speaking, a physical work of architecture. We'll talk about that during the interview. I've wanted to cover this fabulous monster, but I didn't know quite how to tackle it, what angle to take. It's shown up in films like Disney's animated adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the aforementioned Gargoyles, and the regrettable 2014 film I, Frankenstein, which currently sports an overly generous 4% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. One of my hesitancies in covering this monster, despite its widespread public recognition, was the lack of consistency in the folklore and history. There's stories which say the creatures were named after the sound of the gargles of the water that passed through its mouth. There's stories saying it was named after a monstrous dragon-like creature. And there's a mishmash of legends about whether gargoyles are supposed to be figures of good or figures of evil. But despite the inconsistencies in the lore, one thing I think we can agree on is that gargoyles are art. They're a feature of Gothic architecture hundreds of years old, and they served both a serious structural purpose and a glorious artistic one. Thanks to our Facebook keeper, James Nealon, for recommending our guest this week. It's time to crank up our Cradle of Filth albums and get our Gothic on with some gargoyle
monster talk.
So Matthew Duman is a photographer and graphic designer who grew up in Bethany, Connecticut. He attended the gargoyle-free campus of Central Connecticut State University, but while studying abroad, developed a fascination with the grotesque sculptures of the cathedrals of Britain. In addition to England, Matt has made photographic trips to Italy, Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. Matt currently works in New Haven, Connecticut. He began exploring the variety of sculptures found on the buildings of Yale University, and as a personal project, has researched and documented these New World grotesques, which are closer, but no less bewitching than their European counterparts. Welcome to the show, Matt. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
So just to begin with, what is a gargoyle? I mean, I think most of us have seen them, but if you can tell us a little bit about them, I think a lot of people think that they might have a spiritual or a superstitious purpose, or is it practical? You can tell us a little bit about gargoyles.
Well, it's a little of both. Actually, these days in modern times, the definitions have gotten a little muddled. There is gargoyles and there are grotesques. Now, grotesque is the general architectural term for any kind of sculpture on or in a building. And it's usually a person, animal, or fanciful creature. Now, a gargoyle is a specific type of grotesque. Specifically, it's the ones that channel water. So basically, and that's where the word comes from. It comes from the old French word gargui, which is spelled G-A-R-G-U-I-L-L-E, which refers to the throat. Now, that's related to the modern word to gargle, because it refers to water going down your throat, which is what gargoyles, function as. So basically, a gargoyle is a specific type of grotesque, and it's basically a decorative rain spout.
Very decorative. Can you tell us a little bit about the styles and the forms of these? So let me just say before we get into that, I've been wanting to talk about gargoyles because culturally, you know, they fit in as a monster in modern times in all these sort of fictional narratives, like the Gargoyles cartoon. They were in, there was a Frankenstein movie that came out that was kind of horrible that had gargoyles as one of the kind of creatures as sort of protections. And then there was a Stan Winston movie back in the early 70s for TV. But historically, there's not like a huge amount of lore that I could find about gargoyles coming to life or where do they arise from or anything like that. But did you, when you were looking in the research, did you find anything about the people believing that they came to life or were real or in any way represent anything except artistic sort of representations of monsters?
I haven't found anything with people actually believing they were real or came to life. They're really more symbolic. Yeah.
So maybe we could talk about that in they come in a lot of different styles. And in your book, by the way, your book has just a ton of beautiful photography for people who can't make it to Yale to look themselves. You've captured really great photographs of all these different gargoyles and grotesques throughout the...
Yeah, it'd be a great
coffee table. It really would.
Makes me
want to go out and buy
a
coffee table.
Yes.
Just to put it on. Oh, I got coffee.
It's coffee as well, yes.
Oh, sorry. So the question was, can you talk about some of the styles and forms that these gargoyles come in?
Yeah. Well, there's the basic style that everybody's familiar with, which the name conjures up the demonic, frightening imagery. And that's a hangover from the medieval times, where gargoyles were used on churches and cathedrals, and they were there for a few different reasons. One of them was the gargoyles and grotesques were on the outside, but the religious imagery was kept on the inside. So it was basically saying that evil was kept outside of the church. And also some people said it was to scare away evil spirits so they don't come into the church. Also, they were used in maybe a little more practical sense. You have, as I said, they had religious imagery, and then they had the ugly gargoyles. Well, the gargoyles were used to accentuate, enhance the beauty of the religious imagery by comparison.
So I have kind of a follow-up, if you don't mind. I've read a lot of the ghost stories of M.R. James, and a lot of his work talks about, it's fictional, but it talks about the sort of art that is inside churches in England, and like the art that sits on the end of church pews and the art that's like sort of tucked away in various places. Did you get a sense of why there is so much grotesque art within the church? I mean, it seems to be quite a counterpoint to the sort of beauty and majesty of sort of heavenly ideas that the church talks about in some ways.
Well, that brings me to my next style that I was going to say, the more allegorical grotesque. Now, back in the Middle Ages, most of the common person, the peasants, they were pretty much illiterate. So the church had to depend on visual imagery to get its point across. So grotesques and gargoyles were used to show concepts of morality and religion, because basically they couldn't depend on all the peasants being able to read those concepts in books like the Bible. which I think is kind of funny that Yale adopted that sort of thing, because I think most Yale students are pretty literate.
Were all of the gargoyles creatures or monsters of some kind, or were any fashioned after people or famous people in particular?
There's a whole variety of gargoyles. The demonic imagery is just one category. There were, as I said, they could demonstrate morality with different figures, or they could be maybe a statement about the city that the cathedral was located in, or in modern times, which we're talking about, like Yale University, the school itself. They would be at Yale. There's a lot of depictions of Yale's mascot, Handsome Dan the Bulldog. And then there's also a lot of depictions of historical events in Yale's home city of New Haven, Connecticut.
So why are there so many gargoyles at Yale?
Well, Yale is one of the schools that revived the Gothic architecture style. And this revival of Gothic architecture on college campuses is called Collegiate Gothic. Now, this was revived in the 19th century, and it had its roots in trying to raise the school's stature in society, and ultimately to get more money in endowments. Basically, they would build buildings that associated their institution with the medieval universities of Europe, like Oxford or Cambridge. And then they would make them look old to enhance their dignity and venerability, and to make them look timeless. So basically they looked old. People couldn't really say how old, but they looked like they've been there a long time, and they look like they will stand for a long time. And that carried over to their attitudes toward the school itself. The school has been there, and it will be there. And its ideals had been there and will be there a long time.
So how did you get interested in gargoyles, and how did you come to write a book about gargoyles?
Well, it's one of those things, it's like a hobby that just snowballed. I grew up, Bethany, where I grew up, is a little town right north of New Haven. So I was always going into New Haven. I always knew Yale had some great buildings. I never thought too much about them, but I always assumed they were hundreds of years old. And when I started working in New Haven, I was looking for a personal project to get into. So I knew Yale had some nice buildings. So I started photographing around Yale. And I always heard Yale had sculptures on their buildings, but I assumed that they were very stuffy and historical. And that's nice, but honestly, I wouldn't write a book about just that. It was when I started seeing grotesque gargoyles that were very, very funny and just plain bizarre that it's that humor factor that really drew me in. And I started taking pictures, and my hard drive started filling up. And at the time, I was doing some freelance work for a Yale professor, and we got to be good friends. And I would always complain to him that I have all these images, I don't know what to do. And so he said, "Well, why don't you do a book?" And now he probably said it just to shut me up because I was complaining about it. But I said, "Well, I can design it, and I have the photos. I guess I can do it." And it was a good, at the time, it seemed like a good challenge. I never had done anything like that before. So I just started putting together a book, and it was a challenge, but it's been a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
Such a great
it's a
idea.
Really cool book too. I love the fact that you went black and white, because it sort of adds to the Gothic feel.
Well, that's another point I wanted to make. When I first started taking pictures, I took them in color, and I still take them in color originally. But they didn't really have the punch, the effectiveness. It's only when I started playing around with them, one time I put them in black and white, and I realized it brought out the character of the grotesque a lot more. And I realized that since most of these grotesques and gargoyles are not painted, their features are dependent on, you know, the light and dark areas. And the only colors that really would show up in the photo are maybe the sky or leaves of trees, things that are not the grotesques. So basically, the color was only a distraction. So I would convert them to black and white, and the true character of the grotesque really pops and shines
neat.
Through.
I think it's very effective. Yeah. So
beautiful.
Can you talk a little bit about how these are made? I mean, are they sculpted or are they poured into molds? How are these actually crafted?
Well, most of the grotesques at Yale, I would say, are cast from molds. But Yale does have examples of many different kinds of methods that they were made. They also have ones that were sculpted from a solid piece of stone. And you can tell those by, you can actually see like the veins running through the stone. So you could tell that was one solid piece that they sculpted from. There's also others that were carved into wood, and then others that were cast bronze or some other metal. So there's a variety of methods that you can use to actually make a gargoyle. But most of them at Yale are cast concrete.
And were gargoyles usually designed along with a building, or were they something that were added after the fact?
At Yale, I would say in most cases they were designed with the building. And depending on the building itself, the importance of the building, sometimes they even had like the main library called Sterling Memorial Library at Yale. That's actually, it's built to look like a Gothic cathedral. It even has a confessional. It's actually a phone booth, but it looks like a confessional. For those, they actually had a committee with the architect and dignitaries from Yale and some of the masons, and comprised many people involved in the construction, that they would choose iconography to put on the building. And now other buildings maybe that were a little less important, maybe it was up to the masons themselves or just the architect. But at Yale on the whole, they were put up when the building was put up. I've been to other schools where that wasn't the case. They would actually leave blocks on the buildings, and then later, maybe 50, 60 years later, they would come and carve something.
So while you were putting the book together, did you ever happen to visit during a rainstorm so you could actually hear the gargoyles at work?
I never really visited during the rain. I did visit many times during the winter, where you could see where gargoyles, you could tell gargoyles from regular grotesques because they have these long icicle goatees hanging out of their mouths. And those made for some good pictures as well.
But, I was curious as to what they sounded like when the water was coming out of them. Well, I was wondering if they made
a gargoyle noise, sound, right?
Sound
very German.
I mean, everybody sees them all the time, but I rarely ever see them actually spouting water in any of the photographs or, you know, things I see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true. Because, see, I tried to, the reason why I was down in the wintertime a lot of times was, well, there's a lot of trees, even though Yale's in the city, there's a lot of trees around the campus. And I found out the hard way, I started photographing in the summertime. By the end of the summer, I figured I think I got pretty much everything that's around Yale. And then the leaves came off the trees, revealing a whole lot more that I never saw before. So then I realized I was pretty naive to make a statement like that. So now I never say that I've seen everything, because it seems like there's always something more to see. And whenever I go to photograph something, I always try to go maybe in the winter or early spring before the leaves come on the trees. So, because a lot of them can be covered by the leaves.
Speaking of naive, you remind me of Karen had talked about eavesdroppers, which I guess is not really directly naive, but naivesdroppers, a funny portmanteau. Anyway, do you know anything about eavesdroppers, these sort of carved figures built into the eaves in the English architecture?
Yeah, I've read about them. That was, I think, Henry VIII installed those when he was, I think it was at Hampton Court. He was renovating Hampton Court for his purposes. And yeah, they were usually put high up near the ceiling. And those are an actual form of gargoyle. A form of grotesque, I should say. And I think they were there, as the name suggests, as eavesdroppers. It was to remind anyone, either the court or the staff of the palace, that, well, the king is always there and he's always listening. So don't say anything negative about the king, because it'll always get back to him. And I always think that those are a form of grotesque. Now, they're a little different from your normal grotesque, because, well, first of all, they're mostly painted, and most of the, at least the ones I've seen, the details are painted on them, the eyes, the eyebrows, things like that. And I think the painting is intentional, because the people on the ground level can see them a lot better. They stand out a lot better.
Yeah.
So they are a form of grotesque, but they're not, most grotesques are not painted though.
Yeah. I watched a good documentary on eavesdroppers in Hampton Court a few years ago. And so I just wondered if there was a relation between the two of them. I guess it leads me to ask as well, can you ever get gargoyles that are, even though they're designed as water spouts, can you ever get indoor ones for any reason?
I guess if you were somehow channeling water indoors or through inside, maybe up near the roof. I've never really seen them indoors.
But maybe decorative ones that people buy for their houses or something, modern ones.
There are many grotesques that I've seen indoors, but not really gargoyles that channel water. I haven't seen too many of those indoors.
If I remember correctly, these appeared in something like the 600s originally, something. Is that about right? The first time we saw gargoyles being used, it seems like they've kind of like come and gone in popularity. And I was curious as to why they were originally developed. I don't know if you actually looked into that at all. I was wondering what drove them. I mean, they're artistic, but they're also functional. And I just don't know why they seem to have stuck around for so long. They've been around for such a long time to not have any particular, you know, monster lore around them. I'm not really sure what the deal is there. It's sort of a really sticky meme almost.
Well, as you said, in the old days, in medieval times, gargoyles actually had a practical purpose to remove water from the building. They didn't just dump it off the side. They were kind of like spouted it away from from the building. And that was so the water wouldn't just pour down the side of the building and start to erode it. Now, later on, in probably maybe the 15, 1600s, they developed downspouts. And so they could remove water just down the side in a pipe. So the use of gargoyles kind of faded out a bit. But then the style was revived in maybe the early 1800s but more as a kind of a decorative affectation.
But do they exist in other cultures at all? Do they just go back to the Middle Ages, or they go back further than that in other countries or cultures?
Well, they, I've seen them on like ancient Greek temples, and they don't really, they're a little different from the gargoyles that you and grotesque that you imagine. When people think of grotesques and gargoyles, they think of something medieval. But I've seen decorative elements on ancient temples from ancient Greek, ancient Greece around or so that time as well.
So was it draining to do all this work, taking all these photos?
Well, I have to say, I mean, it did get tough, but I have to say, I just kind of went with the flow.
Nice.
Well, Heather, I was thinking he was going to end the conversation at this point.
And scene.
To be serious, the hardest part of doing all this was I had so many pictures, and I'm not a very organized person. The hardest part was just organizing all these photos and editing them all and choosing which ones to use. And as I like to say, Yale is more grotesque than you can shake a student loan application at.
I'll bet.
But I had to develop little organization techniques so I knew which building these photos came from and which part of the building, which ones were close to each other.
Yeah. So James Neeland, who does our Facebook administration, he handles our Facebook group and does a great job with it. He helps keep the friendly tone of the group and
gets rid of spam.
Awesome. But he recommended the book to us, and so I guess he's also from Connecticut. Do you know James, or how did you guys meet?
I was doing a lecture. I do lectures at libraries, and I had one scheduled for Cromwell, which is the town where James lives in. And and he, right about a week before the lecture, he bought a book. And I, after he, when somebody buys a book, I fill the order, send it out, and then I send them an email thanking them and send them the tracking number. So I did that. And then he replied saying that he was, the administrator of this podcast. And that's how I got involved in all this.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, it really is, I think, something that our listeners will really enjoy.
Okay.
It's just full of monsters. There's so many interesting, and I mean, when they say the word grotesque, I think that's very accurate.
Just in general, I like that word because it's a very, it gets a very visceral reaction.
Yeah. And I was just really surprised to hear you say that some gargoyles are humorous. Because I always thought they were grotesque, that they were supposed to inspire fear on some level.
But especially these days, there's a whole variety of different kinds. And as I said, I enjoy the humorous and the bizarre ones the most. And that's what really drew me into this project.
Could you tell us a little bit about maybe some of the humorous ones or the bizarre ones or the scary ones that you've come across researching this project?
Well, there's one. It's not actually on a building. It's on the base of a flagpole at Yale, and it's called Ledyard Flagstaff because it's a memorial to a student, a former student called Augustus Canfield Ledyard, and it's cast bronze, and it was put up by his friends. Now, Augustus Canfield Ledyard, he graduated from Yale in 1898, and then in 1899, he was killed in the Spanish-American War. And then about 10 years later, well, 1908, his Yale friends put this memorial to him. And it has this really, really, well, grotesque face on it. And I was wondering, after I read the story, I kept wondering, like, why would his classmates put such an ugly face at the base of their memorial to him? And then I was thinking about it a while, and then I'm like, well, Ledyard died tragically and much too early. So I think there was a lot of intent behind it because, even on this campus of learning and architectural beauty, this ugly face serves as a shocking reminder of our own mortality and basically not to take life for granted.
I'm looking at the picture because it's like on page 91 of your book. Is that is that maybe Pan? I'm not really sure what that represents exactly.
I think a lot of people said it's Bacchus.
Oh, could be.
Because he has all these like fruits around him.
Ah, yeah.
Because I was looking at it and it looks pretty grotesque and it's over 100 years old. And I was thinking, well, you take off all that tarnish and it's still pretty darn ugly.
Yeah.
even when it was nude, it was probably ugly.
We've talked about the popularity of gargoyles over the ages have risen and fallen. But it seems that a lot of the really old looking parts, the sort of artistic throwback, are not actually that old. Can you talk a little bit about how the gargoyles have come and gone over the history of the college?
Well, I'll start this off with a little anecdote. A few years ago, I was watching a documentary of Windsor Castle in England. And they were interviewing some of the staff. Now, Windsor Castle, it's near Heathrow Airport. So almost all the time, there's always passenger jets coming and going above the castle. And they were interviewing this guide, and he said one time he was showing around, he was taking around a group of Americans. He made sure to state they were Americans. And one of the Americans was asking him, he said, why would they build the castle so close to the airport?
Sounds like an American.
Yeah, nice. So,
and I didn't do that in my American accent, but
as long as you're wearing a baseball cap, that's okay.
turn around behind. So basically, and that's just to show that the Americans have a much different perspective on the age of things than Europeans. Here we see something that's, you know, 200 years old, and we think, wow, that's pretty old. Well, over there, they have buildings from the Middle Ages. They have Roman ruins, which are a whole hell of a lot older than 200 years. As I said before, one of the basic goals of collegiate Gothic architecture was to associate the institutions in America with the older institutions in Europe, like Oxford and Cambridge. And because they wanted to seem timeless and venerable. And it always made me laugh because I was thinking, you look at these buildings like, wow, they're pretty old. But then if you really take it literally, like, do I really think that, you know, a group of Masons came over here in the Middle Ages and and built these buildings in like Chicago and all in New Haven and all these different places around the country? Of course not, you know. But still, they go through great lengths to make you think they're a lot older than they actually are.
Now, it's kind of effective though. You know, it's interesting because I think you can kind of pull it off with gargoyles and the sort of sculptural elements. But if you were to put, say, a stone pyramid up, nobody's going to buy that. It's not going to seem ancient, right? You know,
except for Vegas. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but does it seem all
different?
But I would have to say that 200 years is old to an Australian. Anything that's 100 years old is old in Australia.
Yeah.
Now there are also building. Now a lot of buildings that were built that were the style, the collegiate Gothic style at its zenith, probably about the late 20s, early 30s, were built around that time. At Yale, though, you go in there and you see these buildings that are about, you know, 80, 90 years old. Then between them, there's this little pavilion that's a big stone structure, looks just like the other ones, and it looks very old. But then if you look closely, you'll notice that on the cornerstone, it says 2007.
Nice.
Wow.
See, it's that kind of like little trickery that makes me view Yale less as a community and more as like a theme park.
Are they still adding to the collection of gargoyles at Yale? Is it just something they've finished with that that aspect of architecture, or do they ever get damaged? Do they replace them with new works? Is there any changes, or are they mostly fixed?
Up until a few years ago, I would have said, well, no, this the collegiate Gothic style kind of petered out at the end of the 1930s, and then modernism took over, and now there's all modern buildings and all different styles. But just last fall, Yale finished two new residential colleges, both in the collegiate Gothic style, with grotesques and gargoyles. Now, the interesting thing about these is these were made in the past few years. So, again, they look pretty old, but some of them are very modern in their concept and themes. Like, there's actually one of an iPhone.
Really? Cool.
And that's what I like as well, the kind of anachronistic feel of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fun.
I'm trying to figure out how that would work for having a spout.
Well, iPhone was an actual, that was a grotesque. They have gargoyles of Handsome Dan the Bulldog with water coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of which, so you've got they sort of it's a couple of hundred years of history there. Do they have a, is it possible to ID the sculptors who crafted these?
I really went in and researched, and I couldn't find too many names of the actual sculptors themselves. I did come up with a few names of people who directed the production of the sculptures. There was René Chambellan, who was an architectural sculptor. He did work in New York and Chicago as well. Now, it said he was in charge of the sculpture for Sterling Memorial Library. Now, that doesn't mean he did all of the sculpture. I envision him working with a group of sculptors and masons, and he would be directing them as to what his vision was. But there's very few records of individual masons and sculptors who worked on the buildings.
Did you find any sense of a sort of Dan Brown level hidden mystery or meaning in any of the symbology?
Well, there's another type of grotesque that I like to call reclusive grotesques. And they're basically grotesques that are kind of hidden. Now, you'd think that, you know, they spend money putting these, and they spend a lot of work producing the sculpture and putting it on the building. You think they want people to see it. Well, and then some of them are hidden. Like, there's one on the Hall of Graduate Studies. They have these, at the front entrance, they have these arches, and between the arches, they have these niches, little alcoves that have a little decorated canopy on top, and those are empty. But if you're really particularly curious, you can look up, you can kind of go really close and look up under the canopy and see this little face sticking his tongue out at you. And I like that because you know that wasn't for everybody to see.
Right.
And there's also in the library a corner with decorative work on it. But if you look up underneath, there's a spider, but it's way up underneath. So it's not for general view. And as I was wondering why would people go through the trouble to sculpt something which many people, you know, don't even see? And then I realized, well, what am I doing? If I think when people actually look closely and see these, it inspires them to look closer at all the stonework and enhances the overall experience for them. I mean, something which I can personally attest.
Yeah, they're like Easter eggs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Neat. I've heard of it at Disneyland. Don't they have those hidden Mickeys? They're supposed to be
Mickey Mouses. In my lecture, that's what I say, much like the hidden Mickeys on the Disney theme parks.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of the Disney theme parks, like the Imagineering and things that go into the behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen a lot of relation between that, the building of the Disney theme parks, and the designing and building of a college campus.
Interesting. It's very intricate.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of thought that goes into it.
So, you know, this topic's a little different from a lot of the monsters we've covered on the show in that I don't feel like there was a huge, I don't think there's a lore around the existence of gargoyles as real monsters, but as an artistic feature, you know, they're all over the place and they're gorgeous and interesting. And I highly recommend the book. So if people want to get the book, do you want to send them to Amazon or is it better to have them come to your webpage or what's the best way for our listeners to get a hold of this fascinating?
Well, it's available on Amazon, but it's also available on my website as well. It's probably get a little cheaper on my website, which is www.yalegargoyles.com.
Nice. Okay.
Very cool. So, forgive me if we've already discussed this, but just how many gargoyles are there at Yale?
I get this question so many times, and I can only estimate. Many hundreds is all wow. Is the most specific I can be, because I'm still finding new ones, and I've gotten to the habit of every time I go down there, looking around every little corner and nook and cranny, and sometimes you don't find anything. Other times, you find all sorts of things that you never knew were there. That's what really drew me in at the beginning, because as I said, I was familiar with the university from when I was a small child. It's just, but now when I started discovering all these creatures on the buildings, it gave me a whole new perspective. I would go down streets that I've been down many times in my life, but now I was seeing all these things that I'd never seen before. So it gave me a new perspective on a familiar place.
Sounds like the potential for a sequel, or maybe to even just photograph the gargoyles in different seasons. I think a book on each season would be beautiful. Okay.
Well, that book came out, the Education in the Grotesque came out a few years ago. And since then, as I said, Yale opened up two new residential colleges. So I was there at the gates on move-in day when they opened it to students. And so I photographed them. Plus, I've been to 9 other university campuses, like Duke and Princeton and University of Chicago and City College of New York. And that's what I'm putting together for – that's what the book I'm working on now. It's called The Grotesque 10.
Oh, great. We'll have to have you back on to talk about that.
Yeah.
So when you were cataloging these, what was the scariest imagery that you saw?
Well, there's one at Trumbull College. Now, everybody likes it because it fits everybody's vision of a true grotesque or – it's not really a gargoyle, but that's what people think. That's what people call it. It's this lizard-like demon with a ridge of spines on his back. And the reason why it's kind of scary was, at first, it was kind of far away, and I had to stand on a bench with a big telephoto lens to see it. And I noticed it was holding a crown, and then I look closer and I see something streaming out of the crown. I'm like, is that hair? Is there a head in that crown? I couldn't see an actual head. And the thing is, since it's far away and over the rooftops, I couldn't really see it from many other angles. So I really don't know if there's an actual head in that crown, but it looks like there is.
Creepy.
I mean, you've got so many images in the book, and so many of them are just, I guess, is a combination of grotesque and gorgeous. It's really, really neat.
Well, I tried to, I liked when they were close so I could really experiment with wide angle lenses and getting different angles on something, maybe from below or just, I don't know. I like just seeing what I could do. And because I lived close to campus, I could always take a few pictures, go back home and look at them. And if they weren't right, come back and take them again and try something different.
So does Yale offer any gargoyle tours, or is it something that you've ever thought about offering?
Actually, I do offer that. I do gargoyle tours. I call them grotesque safaris to see gargoyles in their natural habitat. And I actually wear, somebody gave me a photographer's vest years ago. I've never actually worn it to go photographing. It was just in my closet. And then I realized, well, I can wear that. I can get some cargo pants. And then I bought a pith helmet online. So I go around, I meet people down at Old Campus, part of Yale, and I take them around. And
fantastic.
Now, it's fun to wear that whole getup, but then I kind of realized there's a practical purpose as well, because this is in the middle of a city, and a lot of times there's a lot of students or just people milling around. So you have, when you're on the tour, you have to know who to follow. The person, the guide has to stand out in the crowd. And that helps me stand out, and
sure it does. you have any
your vestments? Oh. Yeah. What?
Yeah. And I have a little a sign that I made on the back of the vest that says "The Gargoyle Guide."
Nice.
You get people coming up and asking you about the tours.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think
after a tour, I was walking across the Old Campus, and one of the groundskeepers was like, "Hey, the Gargoyle Guy!" And he's all yelling.
You're famous.
Yeah, apparently.
That's so cool. Gorgeous imagery. Yeah, it really is.
It is. It's just incredible. It's beautiful. And I've always loved gargoyles, being fascinated by them. So this is great that we're finally getting around to talking about gargoyles.
But I have to say, I mean, it really is an effective means of making things look old. I mean, the whole idea of gargoyles, and we have this sort of cultural attachment to it as being a sort of medieval architectural feature. And just by slapping it onto buildings within the past couple of hundred years, it really does make them seem ancient.
Well, I mean, the Gothic style has a lot of features like, you know, spires and wrought iron gates, and all that is to make it look old.
Cloves, but, cigarettes, and
well, that too. But the gargoyles have a little bit of an advantage, because not only do they make it look old, they can actually convey a message. So basically, they can, as I like to say, the buildings can wear their identity on their sleeves. Like they could actually send literal messages instead of just implying a vague notion of age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I still think a couple hundred years is old.
Well, it is.
Now on this topic, there's one architect who went to Yale, and he designed a lot of the buildings, the celebrated Gothic buildings at Yale, the library and the law school. His name is James Gamble Rogers. Now, there's a lot of stories about him. There's one that when he was building one building, a lot of these buildings have like slate roofs. Well, he saw the slates before he put them up, and he didn't like them because they were too new looking. They were right out of the factory. So the story goes that he had them buried in Long Island Sound for about 8 months. And then after he dug them up again, they were nicely old, aged, and pitted and discolored. So then they looked, you know, a couple hundred years old. Then he had them put up. There's another story about him. There's a bell tower in the center of campus called Harkness Tower. It's built in 1921. There's a story that, and he designed that as well. and it has a lot of sculpture on it and all. The story goes, and these are just stories that get embellished over the years, and I can't say I totally believe this, but it's a good story. When they finished the tower, it was the tallest freestanding stone structure in North America in 1921. Well, but he wasn't satisfied with it because it looked too new. Well, obviously, they just finished construction. So the story goes that he had acid poured down the sides to age the building. And the thing was that not only did it age the building, it weakened the structure enough that they had to put steel supports on the inside to hold it up. So it was no longer the tallest freestanding stone structure. Now, the reason why I have my doubts that story, because that would take a lot of acid. The tower is over 200 feet tall, and it would take a lot of acid to cover that whole building. And the stories have him sneaking up to the top of the tower at night and pouring a flask of acid down the side. Now, but as I say, I'm not sure if it's actually true, but it's a good story nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a lot of acid at Yale anyway.
Well, I did kind of acid, yeah.
But that reminds me of just a lot of the tourist scams overseas when people think that they're buying antiques and they're really just modern sculptures and various objects that have been aged or made to look old.
Yeah, there's a rich history in aging artifacts, soaking papers and tea and various other
coffee.
Things. Yeah, exactly.
So. Well, there are quite a few of kind of aging techniques like that James Gamble Rogers and other architects used. One is when sometimes you'll notice some of the stairs have a little kind of depression in the middle of the tread. And a lot of times, sometimes they were actually molded that way. It's supposed to look like it's been worn down over hundreds and hundreds of years.
Straight up cheating is what that is.
There's also things like you'll see a row of windows, and then one window of that set is all blocked up. But if you look closely, you'll notice that the blocks that block up the window are the same blocks that it's used in the surrounding wall. And not only that, they're aged the same, they're worn the same amount, which means they were put there at construction. So it was built with that one window blocked up.
Cheeky.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned before those niches, the empty niche. That's another device they used. They're at the front of the Sterling Memorial Library. I counted there are 22 of those niches. Only one has sculpture in it. The others are empty. Now, it looks like the perfect place for a tall statue. It's a little alcove, and it has a flat base bottom. Well, you're supposed to assume that when the building was originally constructed, quote unquote, hundreds of years ago, you're supposed to assume that they all had sculpture in them. But over the building's long and colorful history, those sculptures were either stolen or destroyed or in one removed in one way or another. So that's another way to make you assume that the building is older than it actually is.
That's pretty clever.
I have a grotesque pun for you.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
You've got my attention.
Well, at one of the side entrances to the library, there's a lamp. And right above the lamp is a beetle, a beetle sculpted in the concrete. And also on either side is the beetle's larvae. Now, I don't know what the actual scientific name of this beetle and its larvae is, but I do know that the common name for its larvae is the bookworm.
Nice. Yeah. So that's very clever.
So as I said, I was drawn in by the humor in these.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's not just that it makes it fun to look at. I think it's kind of incredible that you can connect with someone, i.e. the makers, the sculptors of these, you can connect with them on a personal and emotional level over a gulf of, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. And it's more than just writing some factual information on the wall.
Yeah.
It's actually connecting on an emotional and personal level, I think is amazing.
When you've got to actually commit your pun into stonework, that's a serious commitment.
You got to be serious about it, yeah.
I can see you doing that, Mike. But a lot of attention to detail.
It is. That's fantastic.
Well, Matt, we have a final question that we like to ask our guests, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
Well, I have to go old school with this and say the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh.
Now, I've always loved water old monsters, school. And I visited Loch Ness, and I always thought it was, when I was there, I always thought it was incredible that there really isn't any solid proof of the existence of a monster, but it's a multi-million dollar industry, the tourism.
I didn't say anything.
People are drawn there. And now, that having been said, I also have a soft spot for Frankenstein, because who could resist a monster in a sports jacket?
Well, there is that. Yeah.
Nice.
That's fantastic. Well, Matthew, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. This was fantastic. Your book is beautiful. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, and you've mentioned the URL, but you can mention it again.
Okay, it's www.yalegargoyles.com.
Great. And
we need a picture of him in his pith helmet for the...
If you could.
Send want me to say I have one.
Send it to us. We'll put it in the show notes. That'd be great. And thanks again to James for making the recommendation. This was a really fun talk.
Are you making him blush now?
It's a beautiful book, and I really look forward to buying a coffee table so I can share it with my friends. So
yeah, and some coffee.
I'll have to get to IKEA. Yeah,
classy.
All right. Thank you both. Have a good evening. And Karen, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Matt.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Matthew Duman about his book, An Education in the Grotesque, The Gargoyles of Yale University. A link to his book is in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Please stay tuned to Monster Talk for some really fun upcoming topics. We've got Megalodons, Mothman, some more magic, and even some Bigfoot coming back. Monster Talk's an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music's by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
So we always start by reading the bio, so there you go.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say the Bible.
We always start by reading the Bible.
Really? I wasn't aware.
It's surprising to everyone, including me.